Earth Podcast with your host, Jake Weaver. Engineered by Cedric Swan.
Hey, everybody. We are back with another episode of Midnight on Earth. I'm your host, Jake Weaver, and we are here to bring you more knowledge, more lights, and more love. Today, we have an incredible guest. We're going into the world of Shakespeare, people, and all the mysteries and the codes and the various things attached to it. Today, we have Alan Green on the show, and he has a television series on the Gaia Channel, Shakespeare Decoded, and also a book about the hidden mysteries within Shakespeare's plays, within his writings. It connects historical figures like John Dee and others. It's absolutely mind-blowing. We're going to talk to him in just a second. But first, I need you to do something for me. Follow me on Instagram at @midnight_on_earth. That is the address. You can follow me there. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, wherever you go to get your podcasts, click that button that connects us so you know exactly what is going on. You get that notification to your device. And of course, tell a friend, tell someone that you know that loves these type of podcasts, that is interested in the history and mysteries surrounding this character we know as Shakespeare. You know these people, bring them here. MidnightOnEarth.com. Okay, so we're just about to talk to Alan, but first I have to read his bio. So here we go. Alan Green is a British-born pianist, composer, author, and Shakespeare scholar. His former life in the music business, a top 30 artist in the 80s with CBS and Arista Records, author of award-winning books on the Monkees and musical director for Davy Jones, seems at odds with his current incarnation as a documentarian of ancient wisdom. But his extensive musical training in classical and jazz disciplines has ideally prepared him to recognize deeply embedded patterns that orthodox academics have missed. Alan has spent the last 19 years devoted to deciphering a stunning web of codes hidden within the Shakespeare works, which finally solves history's most persistent cover-up. He's the only person in 400 years to have deciphered the codes that will tell the whole story of who Shakespeare was and the scandalous royal secret that necessitated the cover-up. More than that, he's identified the actual location where the author himself says he left physical evidence and then pulled off the daring heist necessary to secure incontrovertible scientific proof in the form of a radar scan, which is an incredible story, people. You're going to hear about this. Through Alan's online barcode presentations and his Gaia TV series, Shakespeare Decoded, we're finally able to glimpse a previously unsuspected aspect of the world's most popular and influential writer. One so far-reaching, it will create a paradigm shift in how we study literature, history, religion, science, and many other disciplines. And he's here with us today by the grace of all that is. Hello, Alan. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, Jake. That's I had no idea it has such an exciting life. That intro is great.
Well, wow. Being a musician and then tapping into this is huge because musicians deal with patterns. You're thinking chord progressions, how the chords connect, the notes, what notes are a part of one chord that are a part of another. You have to build a pattern-based mind. And then you interface with this Shakespearean information. How did you get in contact with this at first? What was the first iteration of you discovering Shakespeare in this way?
Well, I was not the least bit interested in Shakespeare most of my life, funnily enough, until after I'd gone through my whole musical career, which was until I was 55. And at that point, I was actually praying to leave. I'd had it. I was fed up with this planet, and I'm saying, you can take me. I really don't even like it here. My daughter's off and running. She's doing fine. You know, you can take me unless you have something for me to do, which I kind of suspect, you know. I have that feeling like there's something coming, but I don't know what it is. It was literally that, and that's how I was praying. I was saying, please just show me, or, you know, knock me down with a truck tomorrow. Just make it painless. I just didn't want to stay. I think we've all felt like that sometimes.
I think
right?
so, yes, like, yes.
Yeah. So literally that was it. And a friend invited me to see his one-man show in Beverly Hills. And he says, will you come and support me? And like you do for a friend, you go, oh, yeah, sure, yeah, yeah. What's it about? And he goes, oh, it's about Shakespeare. And I went, oh, well, great. I did not want to go. I honestly was not in the least bit interested. But, you know, it's a friend, so you go along. And sure. In the first 10 minutes, he was not talking about codes at all, but he was talking about the very basic things that we do not learn in school. And it knocked me back. In the first 10 minutes, I went, oh, my God, this is it. This is the thing I've been looking for. So, for instance, he was saying things like, you know, in school we were taught he's the most famous poet playwright in the Western world, right? One of the most prolific writers ever. But did you know that the greatest writer in history never wrote a letter to anyone? Not so much as a note has ever been found.
I didn't know that before reading, watching your series and diving into your book.
Yeah. And, you know, and you think, okay, well, why weren't we taught that in school? You probably heard he wrote the best-selling epic poems, 150-odd sonnets, dozens of the most famous plays in the world, including Hamlet, Midsummer Night's Dream, Macbeth, Romeo and Juliet. But did you know not a single original manuscript has ever been found? Not a play, a poem, a page, a line, a word exists in his own hand. Just six shaky signatures that are all barely legible. They're all spelled differently. And handwriting experts can't even agree they were even written by the same person. So I'm listening to this, and I'm going, that's a mystery. What is that? And then he says, you know, 10 of his plays are set in Italy, and they reveal he's intimately familiar with the locations, the customs, idiomatic language. 13 more plays are set throughout Europe and Middle East and African countries. But the man from Stratford never set foot outside of England. You know, and you're going, okay. And the final couple of things on that, the cherries on the cake is, we're told, well, he's this great scholar, right, of the classics, fluent in multiple languages, unfailingly accurate knowledge of astrology, medicine, botany, Greek mythology, the Bible, mathematics, music, politics, above all, the law. He knows the law. But he didn't own a single book, not even a Bible. And no record exists that he even had the barest minimum of an education. So it's just glaringly obvious there's something up. And that perhaps the most curious of all, and this is not my discoveries, this is just historically accurate once you get into it. And look, the writer had the most successful 25-year career in London's theatres. He would have been like a cross between J.K. Rowling, Steven Spielberg, and RuPaul. all roll into one, yet no contemporary ever reported even seeing the actual playwright. And when he died, no eulogies, no one even noticed. So big mystery. So that's what got me into it. It's very simple.
And I just like to add, Alan, that he never wrote a letter to anyone, which is something I learned from you as well. Never left England, didn't own a book, no original plays, like you said. No one really knew him and no one really noticed his death. Like, what? This guy's supposed to be, like you just said, one of the greatest celebrities, entertainers, entertaining humans at that time. And yet there's nothing. And tell me about the original manuscripts. So they're missing, but what are the oldest ones? Like, how far back do the copies go?
Well, the point is, so, you know, somebody writes the original, right? The author is going to write the original on parchment with a quill, right, you know, by candlelight in his, you know, cute little, you know, tights. Going, But that's then taken by a copyist, and they will copy out the lines for the players in the plays. So they would get what's called foul papers, and they would get, oh, there's my lines, there's somebody else's lines. They wouldn't copy out the whole thing. The original manuscript would be just kept on file somewhere. So what we get is copies of those originals, which are done in the copyist's hand. They're used by the actors to learn their lines and put on the plays, and then eventually somebody will collate them together and print them out as a quarto copy, or eventually as folio copies, big page copies. But that's not the originals,
right? Of course,
the mystery is the originals, the in the handwriting of the master himself, or mistress, or whoever it is, or group of people, whatever it is. We'll get to that. Then they're missing. How can they all go missing? None of them are anywhere. That's a big mystery that does not make any sense. And so I just thought, wow, what a great story. This is what I've been looking for. I will write this as a musical, because that's what I was.
So you felt inspired by your friend's presentation, and being a musician, yeah, you're like, I want to translate this story into a musical using my talents and my understanding of music, right?
So I just thought it'd be like a 1-year gig. I thought I'll research it for a while, write a really cool story about the mystery, make it a musical.
Yeah, everybody loves Shakespeare.
Well, I mean, actually, no, I would say, not everybody knows Shakespeare.
Okay, fine, fair enough.
Love Shakespeare. I didn't love Shakespeare. Other people feel it's, oh, that's musty and old and arcane. But still, when you get the mystery about it, man, that's interesting. Yes. Oh, nobody saw him. Nobody, what I just reeled off, the various facts. So I just thought that was what it was. I thought I was in for a year's gig, and it'd be a lot of fun, and I would research it and write the musical, which is what I started the next day. But it's been nearly 20 years now, and I haven't had a day off. And I'm pretty tired.
And you started your investigation in 2004. This is where you went to the meeting, and you had other experiences around that time that awakened you spiritually. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I know you know what's coming.
I
never talked about this. I didn't talk about this for the longest time because I felt, well, I've got enough on my plate saying Shakespeare wasn't Shakespeare, or not who we think he was, and blah, 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 all the various ramifications. But I shouldn't go into this thing because, it's
we go deep here, Alan. This is what we do. This is what we do.
I understand that now. So I have started talking about it, yes. Instead of saying I just went straight from praying to the divine to show me what it is that's coming, what happened before my friend invited me to the Shakespeare show is that I'm in bed in my apartment in Los Angeles. I'm laying flat on my back. I'm reading a book. And all of a sudden, the electricity in the air became very, very staticky. And I thought, whoa, what's this? What happened? And I could feel three beings, I can only say extra-dimensional beings, just float into the room. And two came either side of my head, and another was off to the back at the foot of the bed. And I mean, I'd never had any experience like this at all. And I was momentarily scared, just for a brief moment. In that moment, though, I called out to the divine, or to I have a guru. And I just called out, guru. And he was there immediately and filled me with bliss. So I knew I was fine. I knew it was okay, but I didn't know what was going on. And I was paralyzed. I couldn't move. And so I hear these beings on either side of my head communicating with each other. It sounded like electric static, didn't know what they were saying. And then they start very clear. I could feel them drilling something into my head. It sounds grotesque. It was quite pleasant. I mean, it wasn't like a Black and Decker,
It was more energy. It was an energy insertion.
It was spiritual surgery. I don't know what really is the right expression, but something was going on where they were doing something inside my brain. And I could hear them, you know, saying, whatever, you know, forceps, swab. I don't know what they're saying, you know, but they put in something, they're doing something inside my brain. But as I say, it was so pleasant and I was so blissfully I wasn't out of my body. I was very much in my body, but it was a great experience. It lasted a couple of minutes. And then they just sort of withdrew, and I could feel that. And then they just sort of floated out of the walls, the same way they came in. I pronounced to my guru, and I could move again, and that was it. And I thought, what on earth was that? I got no idea what. I mean, you know, what do you do? I don't know. It happened twice more. 2 weeks later, it happened again. But this time, you know, it was like, oh, that again. Whoa. And same experience, paralyzed. They came and did an upgrade, I presume. I don't know. I'm just guessing that they, you know, they put in 1.9 and I needed 2.3 version.
New firmware, eight. You're saying? Spiritual firmware.
An upgrade. And it's the same thing, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, floated out again. Happened three times. And then I was introduced to my friend who introduced me to the Shakespeare work. So later I came to realize that, oh, what must have been happening there was they were, well, prepping me for the Shakespeare work. I mean, there's no other way to think about it, because all of a sudden now I could do things that I wasn't previously trained in. I wasn't trained in higher mathematics. I wasn't trained in geometry. I certainly wasn't a cryptanalyst or a cryptographer. And yet I found I had this tremendous knack for just being able to spot the codes that were part of the Shakespeare story that I didn't suspect at first while I was writing the musical. It came later that I realized, wait a minute, there are actual codes here. And yet I can recognize them. And you mentioned something about pattern recognition. That's absolutely yes. Right. I'm a jazz pianist. Particularly if you're playing jazz, but any kind of complex music like classical music, you are pattern recognition. It's like cryptography in real time. A bass player plays a line, you echo it back, maybe transpose it, maybe invert it. The guitarist picks it up and goes, and you're catching patterns on the fly in real time. It's very exhilarating, and sometimes you don't even know how you've done it, right? It's like, right. Where did that come from? But it's great. That's why jazz players just love playing jazz. You know, they're not going to make any money at it, obviously.
Well, some people
they
do.
But they just love being out on the without a safety net, you know. So the ability to do that is an advantage. But really, it went beyond that, because it was about sort of, I started to see codes that once you see them, you can't deny that they're there, and they can be shown easily in a presentation and proven. Yeah, that just all started to happen.
Wow.
So obviously the result of the ETs, whatever they were.
So they come in, these extra dimensional beings, they're giving you this energetic upgrade. They're allowing you to translate the information. They're either implanting something or shifting your frequency in such a way that when you get exposed to this information later, you can see the patterns, you're processing it. You were already kind of primed for it as a musician, but this was something else. You needed that extra software, perhaps, or however you want to use the metaphor, in order to process it. And then it changed your frequency, which then attracted the situation with your friend and the Shakespeare information that you were exposed to, which then led you on a whole different life journey. Now, when did you first see the codes? Your friend wasn't talking about the codes. This was something you discovered. So tell me how that happened.
Well, I'd written it as a musical. It took about a year and a half. I thought it was pretty good. But of course, the research that you have to do goes into all kinds of areas that I was not familiar with at all, having really avoided Shakespeare anyway all my life, which turned out to be a plus, because it meant I didn't have to unlearn a lot of the orthodox story. I came to it fresh from a different perspective. But after doing the musical, a lot of my friends were saying, you know, Alan, it sounds a bit more like it's a Da Vinci Code thriller, doesn't it? I mean, it's like there are codes that you're beginning to see and discover. Perhaps you should write it as a novel. And I took note of that, and I started to write Well, I actually had a download about, of an entire story, but that's perhaps another whole. But I had a. I'd written it as a whole, basically as a novel, a modern day expose on understanding what the codes were about. But I had no actual codes, and as I was finishing it off, I said to myself, you know, what if you get on, you know, Oprah or Charlie Rose at the time or something like that, and they say, have you ever been to, you know, have you been to Stratford? No. Do you know anything about Renaissance codes? No, I haven't really studied. I just made them up like Dan Brown did. You know, it was, I just thought, I'd better go. So I went to Stratford, and literally it was just, I walked in, I saw the gravestone, and I can only explain it by saying that the codes involve punctuation as well as letters, which is unusual for cryptanalysts, but it was John Dee's particular methodology. So we'll get into him later. But John Dee had really invented this whole idea of using punctuation as well as the characters to put them into a grid to reveal other hidden messages. And I just saw something in the gravestone that was, I don't know, it just jumped out at me. It was obvious. On the real gravestone, there's a colon. On the rubbing that they sell you in the tourist shop, it was a period. And I looked, I compared the two, and I went, oh, why is there a difference? So I then started counting punctuation. Once I counted the punctuation, and this will make sense if I tell you one other thing, so let's get into that. But it was through counting the punctuation and the characters that I realized I was onto something that was really inarguable. It was obvious, a plain, simple fact.
But I just want to ask you really quick, Alan, why are they selling a rubbing that's inaccurate? Is it suppression of information?
I don't know. I mean, I thought about that at the time. I thought, well, that maybe that's they're deliberately trying to send.
It's just strange because it's, you know, you think they would go check it and be like, hey, there's a missing, and it's very prominent, the punctuation that's missing. And then they're selling this as authentic. Somebody should have caught that, but you did.
I can't say it was deliberate. That would be a bit unfair to the tourist mongers who are doing that. I don't know, you know, but it was definitely stood out. And I went, but that's what alerted me.
Right.
It was like the difference of one dot. And I went, aha, I'm going to count what that means if I actually include the proper dot. So that was what led me to it in the first place. Yeah.
Wow. So you go there and then you're a part of that energy. Now you're getting downloads. Is it a past life experience? Have you thought about this? Is there some other lifetime that you had that's connected to Shakespeare and that era and De Vere and all the people that are connected with him, John Dee?
You know, Jake, I don't go there. I do know what I was in the original story, but I just feel it's a bit of a circus to go into that and say, well, but you know, it's all of that is so, look, I've met, since giving presentations on this, I've met, well, I don't know, 17 John Dees, 4 Shakespeares, 3 Joan of Arcs, and a partridge in a pear tree. I mean, everybody who feels they have a past life experience, it's always somebody famous and wonderful.
Right. It's not like the dishwasher of the Pharaoh.
Oh, hey, I just realized I was a plumber in Afghanistan. You know, so what? No, I was a king. I was the Pharaoh. I was Queen of Sheba. You know, it's always that way. So start talking. The only thing I say is, no, I wasn't Shakespeare. Because the people, they go, oh, you must have been Shakespeare. No, I was not Shakespeare. Absolutely, categorically. You can set that to rest, but who I was, I don't talk about.
Right, but that energy, you must have been connected to it in some way because it's a little beyond just being a pathway, a chosen pathway for that information. There must be something in the light codes that make up you as a person. But tell me more about the crypts.
And of course, it was awakened by the extra-dimensional beings, of course.
Right. You know?
Tell you about the what?
The altar. You started to notice anomalies at the altar. And tell me about that, and tell me how Shakespeare is buried in the layout of all that.
Okay. Really can't get to that without telling you something first. So do you mind if I just tell you something?
Of course, yes, please.
Otherwise, we'll sort of leapfrog over that, and then it totally makes sense. It's simple. He either is the man from Stratford, who was born actually Guglielmus Shakespeare. Guglielmus was Latin for William. So let's say he's William Shakespeare. It does not have a soft A as in Shakespeare. There's no E in it. And that was quite a common name in Warwickshire at the time. So to differentiate him from another Shakespeare who might be the real Shakespeare, I usually say Shakespeare. So he's either the man from Stratford, Shakespeare, or he's someone else. I mean, that, right? Self-evident. As one of the leading candidates is Edward de Vere, 17th Earl of Oxford, it turns out there are some uncanny connections between those two people. For instance, the man from Stratford, the church records say he was baptized on April 26. That's 426. Let's look at de Vere. History tells us he died on June 24th, 624, the mirror image of it. Yeah, he was the Lord Great Chamberlain. He was a notorious public figure. Just like the silence around Shakespeare's life, when he died, no one wrote a word about it. So there were these connections. Similarly, when Shakespeare died, greatest, most famous poet, playwright, there were no eulogies, no outpourings of grief. No one wrote about it. So now enter this wonderful character, John Dee, yes. Dr. John Dee. He's an astrologer, mathematician, cryptographer, spy for the Queen. Code number, many people know this,
007. Yes.
Ian Fleming based James Bond on him. He's a wizard. He's the original Dumbledore. He was a very pious man. He fasted and prayed and communed with angels who... Now, here's where it gets really deep in the weeds of you. Oh, I get it. Yeah. In 1584, the angels channeled to him something that eventually is called the Enochian Tables. It was channeled to him on June 24th, 624.
Right.
It contains 624 squares with characters in each square. Now, in Holy Trinity Church, where Shakespeare's buried, there's a monument and a gravestone, and they both make no sense. The text is obviously cryptic. It just doesn't make any sense. There's mistakes in it. There's bad Latin. There's bad rhyming. So it's cryptic, and you think, okay. And there's another place where there's an obvious cryptic message, and that's in Shakespeare's sonnets. So all three of those have been suspected for a long time to be codes. I'm not the only person to have stumbled into that. Many people have written a book on each of these subjects, the monument, the gravestone, the dedication. What I think they fail to see is that they are all connected as to one big, huge, monumental code rather than being little codes on their own. So in the monument, there's a group of symbols, letters ligatured together. That means, when you have two letters that are hooked together in typography, it's called a ligature. And they mimic an esoteric symbol of the Freemasons called a triple tau. It's a T and an H connected together. It's called a triple tau. The secret Freemasonic code for the name of God. So that is in the monument. And you see in the monument, there's these symbols and they're arranged in a pattern of 4 and 2 and 6, left to right, or Hebraic fashion, 6 and 2 and 4. So there's those numbers again.
Right.
And blended together, there's this telltale sign of it's a Freemasonic code. Now, the sonnet's dedication, the words are arranged as three inverted triangles in 6 lines and 2 lines and 4 lines. The Freemasons were supposedly formed, got together in 1717. When? What day?
June 24th, I'm going to guess.
624.
Wow.
So I added up all the characters in the three touchstones, in the gravestone, the monument, and the sonnet's dedication. And this is where that other dot comes in, because when I used the rubbing, all the characters added up to 623. And then I went, wait a minute. The actual gravestone is a colon. So there's two dots. So all the characters in those three, the gravestone, monument, and the sonnet's dedication, add up to 624. So it's actually simple. You simply place the 624 characters in the dedication, monument, and gravestone over the 624 squares of the Enochian tables. They fit perfectly down to the last dot. Now, as in any cryptographic code, you need a key. So you have to know what that is, and that's a longer story. But the sonnet's dedication is signed by Thomas Thorpe, and it's a TT at the end. But that's TH, isn't it? Thomas Thorpe. And it's a TH again. It's a little nudge, a little, ooh, are you in the club? You know, I'm a Freemason, are you? You know, so it's a TH. So I just knew, oh, the key is the TT. So you look for anywhere in the sonnets and the monument, the gravestone, where that's called the ciphertext, where there are double T's together. It turns out there's five sets of them. So then you follow where those double T's point across to the Enochian tables, which is called the plain text, and they point out 10 letters that spell out living page. Now, what doesn't happen, living page, what does that mean? A document, maybe, a page, living, preserved, maybe, been preserved, been kept alive, it's alive. Have a look, you know, it's telling you, oh, there's something here. What doesn't happen in ordinary cryptography is to have the key in both the plain text and the ciphertext. But if you look at the Enochian tables, there's five sets of double T's in the Enochian tables as well. And they point back to the ciphertext letters in the grave monument and sonnet's dedication. And they spell out yo stigmata. Well, yo in medieval times was a word that meant look at, but not just look at. It means really pay attention to. Place all your focus on stigmata. What are the stigmata? The stigmata are the Christ's stigmata wounds, the two in the hands, two in the feet, and the spear in the side. Where are those? Well, there's the five stigmata wounds in a church, especially a Catholic church, which this was when it was first founded in 1210 AD. They're in the Holy of Holies altar stone. They are on the surface of the altar stone where Mass is celebrated, and they're cut into the surface. So there should be four crosses, one in each corner and one in the center. So it's saying, living page, yo, stigmata, look carefully at the stigmata. Well, that's obviously the Holy of Holies altar stone. Now, if we're not, you know, we can follow along with that. Now is when it gets superhuman, because John Dee was dealing with extra-dimensional beings. He was in communion with angels who were giving him this information in huge downloads. He had an accomplice called Edward Kelly, who was actually clairvoyant. John Dee himself was not clairvoyant. Kelly could see the angels. Kelly could see the letters of fire, 6 foot high, coming in. Boom! And on this day, on June 24, 624, when they're delivering the Enochian tables to him, they're coming in like, bam, put that letter there. Bam, put that letter there. And they told him exactly where to place it all in this enormous grid. Wow. But there's a clue in the play in Twelfth Night where a character, Malvolio, is trying to solve a code. And it's four letters. And he's reading this in a letter, and it says, M-O-A-I doth sway my life. And he's having a hard time solving this. It's in the play. It's never solved in the play. But there's a clue. He keeps on saying it over and over, M-O-A-I. And then there's a line that says, if this fall into thy hand, revolve. Well, it turns out to be as simple as that. You just revolve it. If you revolve M-O-A-I, you get I-A-O-M and I-A-O-M. If you do enough research on it, you find out that is this Freemason's most secret code of all. Under penalty of death, you must not reveal it. And it turns out it's not a word. It's a pranayama technique of sounding the letters I-A-O-M, like E. Ah, and om, it's for raising the energy up the spine, just like the Vedic scholars of old and gurus and, you know, do. It's pranayama technique for getting to higher consciousness. So Shakespeare's giving this away in a play called Twelfth Night, and the clue is revolve.
Wow.
So okay, but this isn't even possible, because I did send the TTs across from here to the Enochian tables, says living page. Send the TTs across there, says yo stigmata. Are you really supposed to revolve the whole thing? Now the TTs are going to point to completely different letters here. And these TTs are going to point to completely different letters here. As I was doing that, I thought, no, this cannot be. And yet inside I knew, I just knew. I thought, yeah, it is. And whoever did this is superhuman. So you do it, you revolve it. And then the letters go across. They now spell, I have hewn desiderata. I have hewn. Hewn is a word we hardly use these days. It means cut into stone. Desiderata is Latin for my desires, what I want you to know. So the whole thing is a Shakespearean rhyming couplet. It says, living page, yo stigmata, I have hewn desiderata. It's telling you there's a document been kept preserved. Look closely under the stigmata wounds under the Holy of Holies altar stone where I have cut into stone what I want you to know.
Wow.
It's as simple as that. And when I got that, I went, oh, that's it. Bingo. Got it. It's in the Holy of Holies altar stone. Therefore, all I've got to do is get there and get into that altar stone.
Wow. Well, look, I got to back you up because the story of how you do that is legendary. You're a legend for doing that. It's just absolutely amazing. But what was going on with John Dee? Okay, so was that channeling, that Enochian table channeling, like a paradigm shift for spiritual people in that area in Europe during that time? Because if it was so powerful that Shakespeare and John Dee, DeVries and John Dee worked to integrate this into the plays in a geometric, sacred way that, again, is superhuman, what was it about that channeling that affected people so profoundly? I mean, you're communing with angels. That's already huge. But there was something about that that was so powerful, that 624 experience, that it blew everyone's mind at the time. What was going on there?
Well, in actual fact, Jake, you're sort of jumping the gun a bit because it didn't blow anybody's mind at the time. I mean, nobody knew about it. That's the whole point.
But Shakespeare did.
They were using it, but it didn't blow anybody's mind. Dee was doing this in private. He couldn't admit to communing with angels, or he'd be being burned at the stake.
Oh my God!
Because the church can't let you commune with angels. No, that's our providence. You know, you can't be doing that. Right. So that was a no-no. So all of that was done in secret. So when he wrote it all down in masses and masses and masses of diaries and paperwork. And that paperwork was hidden away in a chest of drawers and wasn't found until 60 years after John Dee's death. And then it was only found by sheer luck somehow. But it was the angels, obviously, directing people to go find it. Such that when they took it out, it escaped the fire. A great fire of London came in 1666, and it would have completely wiped out all of John Dee's stuff, and we would never have known the secret to the Shakespeare mystery. But it was actually taken away the night the great fire of London came in 1666. 90% of the homes in London were destroyed. 90%.
Wow.
London. They were all destroyed. But the woman in the household took all these papers, which was John Dee's things, which hold the clues and the codes, and she gave them to somebody who recognized that they were important. And then that person immortalized them by copying them and making sure that they were then safe. But again, no, it wasn't as though it was knocking people's socks off. I mean, nobody knew about it. Nobody knew there was even an altar stone to be the focus of all of this, because the altar stone itself was hidden away around about 1535 when Henry VIII decided we were not going to be Catholic anymore because he wanted to marry Anne Boleyn. The Pope said no, and he said, well, we're not Catholic anymore, we're going to be Protestants. So they took the Catholic altar stone, hid it deep under the church, and it was not found for almost 300 years. So it was not found again until 1889. So no, it wasn't as though it was knocking anybody sideways and going, oh, this is obvious. Nobody knew about it.
But well, what about the Freemasons? What about the Freemasons? Could John Dee have possibly communicated with the Freemasons of the time to kind of bounce his experiences off of that? Well, and then that Freemason network maybe had access to that knowledge. What do you think about that?
I think you're absolutely right. And that is the only way that it would have survived in someone's consciousness through the Dark Ages. We were just coming out of really the Dark Ages. Kali Yuga was, you know, the end of the Renaissance. We're just now into another yuga called Dwapara Yuga, where we're supposedly going higher. Doesn't yes. look like it, no, but we are.
No, we are. We are.
I think it's quite likely that there are high-ups in the Rosicrucian and Freemasonic fraternities who really did know that a code had been left by the Shakespeare people. Let's just call them for now a cabal of John Dee, Edward De Vere, Francis Bacon, and maybe even Shakespeare himself. I don't rule anything out. I mean, sure. It's quite possible that they're all totally in on this together as a symbiotic relationship. But yeah, they probably did know, but still, the altar was nowhere to be found. You see, that's the missing piece until that gets found again in 1889 when they're renovating the church, where I am now in Stratford at that church. We'll get to that. So, it's possible that there are some cognoscenti, let's put it, who really do know this story, but they'd still be looking for where was the secret hidden? You see, so far I've just said sonnets, dedication, monument, gravestone, 624 characters, 624 characters in the Enochian tables, put them on top of each other. Living page, Yosef Mader, I have hewn desiderata, it's in the Holy of Holies. But there was no Holy of Holies for it to be in. It had been taken down into the catacombs of the church in 1535 when the Reformation started, right. And it wasn't found again until 1889. So even though the codes were saying that, there was no way of solving it until the altar was found and brought back up. And then they'd go, ah, there's the altar. Perhaps there's something in there.
Well, you did something really amazing. Let's tell people about the altar, your story, your heist story about how you got in there under different pretenses and were able to scan the altar with scientific, powerful equipment. Please tell us briefly about this.
Right. Well, it's one thing to have discovered codes and to talk about it and say, you know, Alan says it's living page, your stigma, right? If you and desiderata, it must be in the altar stone. But you know what? Most people are going to go, yeah, well, you're a nutcase, right? I mean, unless you've got the patience to watch my presentation for half an hour or 45 minutes, which most people don't have unless they're really dedicated to finding out the truth. And even then, they're still going to say, well, is it there? Is it in the altar stone? I'm just saying the codes say he's left something inside the altar stone. But unless I can actually prove that, no one's going to take me seriously. So 13 years ago, once I knew that it was in the altar stone, I then began to cultivate the church. I did six visits to the church in 4 years, helped them with various projects to raise money for the Celestery Windows and this, that, and the other. As I was ingratiating myself and being useful to them and telling them that I'm writing a Shakespeare musical and that perhaps I'd like to put on excerpts of the show in for the congregation, etc. So they knew me, they began to trust me. There were other connections that involve what you mentioned in the intro about me being Davy Jones of the Monkees, musical director,
right.
As it turns out, the Bishop of Coventry, who you'd have to go to get permission to scan the altar stone. Turns out he was a big Monkees fan. and so I actually went to him and I said, hey, you're a Monkees fan. Because he said, oh, yeah, I always use, I say in my sermons, I'm a believer. Right. So he would say, I saw his face. Right. Now I'm a believer. So we kind of hit it off, and I had a whole day with the bishop, and I showed him the codes and said it'd be cool if I could radar scan it, and he said no. So and he didn't actually say no, he made an excuse and said, well, I'd have to take it to a higher authority. But the point is, yes, I had to get to the altar stone. How am I gonna do that? Because without the proof that there's something there, this would just die on the vine. It's all very well to say it says this and it means this, but when are they going to actually open that altar stone if it's just an idea? So I go to the church, and there's two things protecting the altar stone. They have 24-hour CCTV cameras, And they have a forensic system that sprays you with a chemical if you get too near the altar, if you're not permitted to be there. And they used to have a sign on the door. I notice now that I'm here, they don't have that sign there anymore. But I've got pictures of it, and it said literally this: forensic system, don't risk it. 100% conviction rate in court. In other words, it sprays you and it stays on your body or your clothing for 12 months, and they can then shine an infrared light on you. So, I mean, it's like, what? Why all this James Bond security? Like, okay. But I had to be able to get past that. So the way I did it was to convince them that I was going to do a show, excerpts from my musical, and put the grand piano right next to the gravestone so that they would have to turn off the forensic system because they can't spray their guest artist, you know. And at the very end of the show, during this dress rehearsal, actually, there was a small audience there while we were just practicing it. And I said, let's turn all the lights down and let's do this last number by candlelight. Why? Because it's going to be dark. And I put a banner up in front of the altar stone advertising the musical. So it completely covered. It was like 12 feet by 9 feet. You could not see the altar stone. So while I'm playing piano and singing the last song of the musical, I had two people go back behind the banner, one with a radar scanner, the other filming it in night vision so that we had proof that we'd done it. We didn't take anything. We didn't steal anything. We laid a protective cover down on the altar so that it would be protected. All we took was zeros and ones. We sent those to two separate labs in the United States who analyzed them separately. They both came up with the same result, and you've seen it. You can see it on the Gaia Show, or you see it on my video on my website. To be or not to be.org, and it's called the Stratford Heist. And you can see that it's this: every consecrated altar stone, Catholic altar stone for Mass, has to have a tiny little saint's reliquary inside it. It's called a saint's cavity, and they put a little box in about the size of a child's shoebox that contains relics of a saint, what Rome says is a saint. Well, they send over slivers of bone, piece of clothing, some part of the saint's writing. Whoever Rome says is a saint, they stick that in, they cut a hole in the solid marble huge rock, which is this one in Holy Trinity, is 9 foot long, 3 foot wide, 2 feet deep, cut a hole in the bottom, put the reliquary inside, put a piece of that stone back in, cement it in, incise the five crosses on the surface, and now it is what's called consecrated. And the Catholics then can have Mass at that altar stone. So that's the setup, right? When you scan it, there should be a tiny, tiny little blue area. But as you've seen, you can see it on my online, on the website. It's the hole is 250 times the size it's supposed to be, and it's filled with layers of different densities that you can see there's something in there.
Oh.
So what that did was it absolutely proved that the codes were genuine, because otherwise you obviously would not, you know, you wouldn't see a gigantic hole there. So the codes are genuine. My theory is genuine because it proves that. And then we hopscotch over the need to argue over if my interpretation of the codes is right, because it obviously is. It's there. You can see it. Yes, the codes say there's going to be a gigantic hole there where Shakespeare has put something inside the Holy of Holies altar stone. Shall we go have a look and find it? Because it's right there.
It's right there, and the scan proves it. And I felt like your show, Shakespeare Decoded, the Gaia Channel, did a fantastic job of recreating that altar on the set. I thought the set.
I made that. I made that. Out of polystyrene. I made that at home in Los Angeles and drove it. I got a huge piece of polystyrene and made it to be exactly the exact replica of the original.
Wow. Yeah, I thought Gaia did that for you, but you did that. It's amazing. They did create a beautiful set for your show. It's beautiful.
The set was gorgeous. Yeah. But you have to see it. The reason I did it's that mind is, blowing. Again, it's visceral. To just see a picture of it is one thing, but to actually be able to spin it around and touch it and feel it, it gives you a whole other sense of, wow. Imagine trying to cut a hole that big into a solid block, a 3-ton marble block.
I know.
It would take months and months and months. You would have to be so careful. And the slightest wrong hit with a hammer and chisel, you're going to break the whole thing open. So how did they do it? The only way they could possibly have done it is that John Dee and Francis Bacon both were experts at knowing how to burn into marble with some kind of acid and chemical, because they were alchemists. And they must have done it that way. And they also were experts in knowing how to create a vacuum. Because if you're going to put something in there that's going to last, you hope, until it's open 400 years later, it's got to be a vacuum, else it will all go to dust. So once all the stuff is in there, you'd have to know how to suck all the air out of it, keep it a vacuum, seal it up, and do. And that is what has happened. The scan proves that.
Wow, it's mind-blowing. But here's what I want to ask you is, okay, the book came out in 2012. You have the series on the Gaia Channel. But now that the information is out there, do you think the authorities perhaps removed what you discovered, or perhaps have investigated it on their own? Like, what do you think about that? Did you uncover something and then they're like, oh my goodness, he found it, and now we have to move it?
I was always concerned about that, Jake, obviously, because that would be one possibility. You'd think, well, maybe they might go behind the scenes. But once you know the lay of the land there, the altar stone itself, it's all concreted into the floor. It's concreted into the back wall. I had previously filmed every square inch of the altar. So if they had done anything to get at it, it's just not possible. They would have had to have invented a gas leak and said, we're going to need to close the church for a couple of weeks in order to pull it out. It's just not possible. It's totally concreted in. And so I know that it's still there. There's no doubt about that. So the only question is, are they willing to look at the situation and say, yeah, well, I think we should look. So that's what I'm doing there right now. I'm literally suggesting to them. Well, I'm doing two things. I'm doing a prayer vigil. And the reason I'm doing a prayer vigil there is I'm at the church every single day praying for several hours each day for 10 weeks. And the reason I'm doing that is because, well, first of all, it's to draw attention to the mystery, right? Because people are going to come and say, what's this weirdo doing sitting there in that same place? I mean, they're already asking. They're looking at me sitting there meditating, praying for 3 hours, you know, and they're going, he hasn't moved. He's not moved yet. What's he doing? You know? I mean, believe me, they're all on high alert. Some of them are very, very, very friendly and very open to the possibility of opening the altar. They are. They've already said we would not be resistant to it. It's just that it's not our decision to make. It's the decision of who? Well, the head of the church, and that's King Charles. And King Charles is having his own problems right now, right? Of course,
right.
Poor guy. Is pretty sick with cancer. So we don't know quite how that's going to go. But I would say that the church is honorably, they are not averse to the idea of, and I'm not saying just open it, because that's you know, that's a big deal to crack it open. You should first do an even better scan than I did, because I had to do it with a tiny handheld scanner so that we were not detected. But you could do it with a big scanner, get a better picture of what's in there. Secondly, after that, you could put a micro camera in through, you know, like they do in medicine now, just through a tiny crack in the bottom where the rock was originally cut open. And you can turn a camera around and see what's in there. So if they do those two steps, that's non-invasive, it's non-destructive, and nobody should have any, you know, excuse or to reason to say, well, we shouldn't do it because it's a holy relic, you know. The thing is, I liken it to this. If we knew, well, we know where, say, Da Vinci died. You go to Da Vinci's apartment and say we scan the wall and we find that there's a false wall here. There's 18 inches of space between that wall and there. I wonder if he left anything in that space in the wall. Shall we have a look? Nah, let's not bother. It's probably moldy, you know. Beethoven's apartment, you know, you go to there and there's a cellar and there's a big iron chest with a padlock on it down there. I wonder if Beethoven's 10th is in there. Shall we have a look? Nah. Well, it's the same situation here, except we have nothing of Shakespeare. We don't have the manuscripts. We don't have the plays. We don't have the poems. We don't have a page. We don't have a line. We don't have a word in his own hand. We think of Da Vinci. We already had 19 paintings of Da Vinci and all his sketches and stuff. That one of the paintings cropped up and it was put on auction 4 years ago, Salvator Mundi, sold for $500 million.
Yes, I remember.
One painting. If we found just Hamlet, or anything, it's priceless.
Yeah.
The church, slap it up on a wall, put a little museum next to their church, charge whatever they want for the world to come walking to see it, and all their monetary problems would be over forever. Not that they would do it for the money. They would do it for the right reason, the spiritually right reason, which is to say, hey, Shakespeare is telling us he wants us to find out what's there. This is his last wish. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm drawing attention to it by I'm praying there every day, which is getting some attention. I'll be speaking about it, obviously, on shows like your own. Maybe the newspapers will eventually come and start doing stories about this weirdo. What's he doing sitting there doing that? And I can just explain, well, I'm doing it because if you love Shakespeare, as you we all admit to, don't you want to answer his last wish? He clearly is saying, I want you to see. I've put something here that will get rid of that mystery of who I was and why there seems to be a cover-up.
Do you think there's even more, though? What do you speculate is in the altar? If you were to just intuitively kind of channel guess, what does your intuition tell you is in the altar?
Yeah. In John Dee's diaries, he states very, very clearly that the angels instructed him to put seven bundles into the altar. Now, I know what, it's hard to say. I mean, I don't like to ever say something that I cannot prove. I do know, I would bet 99.999% on that I know the sonnets are in there, because there's a code that simply says the sonnets in the original hand of the author are in there.
Wow.
And the sonnets are his spiritual work. The plays themselves, I do not think, are in there, because the plays, the comedies, the histories, the tragedies are all about life on earth. They are literally everything from bestiality to cannibalism to, wars and bastardy and everything imaginable. The whole panoply of life, heaven and hell on earth, and it's not really sacred. You wouldn't put it into the most sacred place in the church. Plus, there's not enough room even for that, for 36 plays. I know the sonnets are there, and this is going to sound outrageous, but I do believe the Philosopher's Stone is in there because...
Really?
Because there are codes that say so, yeah. Now, what that is that the original... the powder, the red powder that was used in alchemy that supposedly could convert lead into gold, or is it the true spiritual alchemy of converting the lead of the ego into the gold of the soul? There's two perspectives
right.
of what alchemy really is. I think it's probably a mixture of both, but John Dee says, in a way, that it's in there. But there's other things, because it's not, as you know, from looking at my work on the Bard Code podcasts that I've done, etc. There's a lot of mathematical stuff going on.
Oh, absolutely.
The cover of the sonnets, for instance, has sacred geometry on it when you connect the dots of the punctuation. And it actually gives you the geographic coordinates of the Great Pyramid of Giza.
Right.
And, I mean, what's that doing there? I mean, what? Why are you pointing us to the Great Pyramid? Well, because ancient wisdom has a lot to teach us. So I think there's a high possibility that there are things in there that are really useful to us scientifically. It could be the secret to anti-gravity. It could be the secret to how they built these monuments, the pyramids. I don't know. I'm only speculating on that. But it would not surprise me if it's equally, because it's alchemy. It's both sides of the brain.
Right.
It's not just poetry and the creative aspect of the plays. It's the left brain. It's the math, the science, the physics. And he's always going on about both of those. He says they're equally important. And so I think there's stuff in there that would actually tremendously benefit us. Again, speculation, free energy. But I do believe it's there. And we should have a look, obviously.
Yes, because as you point out, there's other codes. It's not just about the altar. The speed of light, before people even realize the true measurement of the speed of light, it's like almost there. There's other codes there. Now, was this Hermetic, Freemasonic, ancient wisdom that was available to these people? We're wondering, how did they know the speed of light? How was he able to point us to the coordinates of the pyramid? They had to have some other knowledge, the secret occult knowledge that they were able to integrate into all of this, including, you're saying, things that we haven't even discovered yet in modern times, at least in our general consciousness. It's all there. They knew all of these things. What is that about?
Well, you just hit the nail on the head. It's the ancient wisdom that is always passed down through what is the very reason for these secret societies and fraternities. It is to protect the great knowledge that we know in the higher ages from completely dissipating and disappearing in the lower ages and as never having being able to get it back, right? It's usually handed down through these secret societies. That's the original purpose. So you get the modern day Freemasons, but they were preceded by Rosicrucians, and definitely Shakespeare and John Dee and Bacon were Rosicrucians. There's no doubt about that. And I could give you a couple of instances to show that simply. But back before that, there's the Knights Templars. And back before that, there's the Egyptian mystery schools. It's all a lineage that is all about literally keeping the flame alive of knowledge, of scientific knowledge, yes, right, and spiritual knowledge. And so it's been kept alive. So that is in the altar for sure. And it's how they knew these other things, like you mentioned, speed of light. That takes a bit of explanation for people to understand, but it's actually quite simple. I just had the intuition that obviously, there were hints that told me that they knew, you know, speed of light. We did not know properly until 1907, when Einstein was using it from in his calculations for relativity. But, you know, we should not have known it back then. Roma got the speed of light like 60, 70 years after Shakespeare, but he was 20% out. He did it by measuring the Venus transit and all of that. But he's 20% out, but he gets the credit for being the first person to have discovered and calculated the light. But it's simple as this: speed of light. Go to the sonnets that contain the word speed. Look at the sonnet numbers that contain the word speed. And it's just two sonnets, 50 and 51. And it's in sonnet 51 twice, and it's in sonnet 50 once. So that's 51, 50, 51. That's the angle of the Great Pyramid.
Right.
50 degrees and just between 50 and 51 minutes. Get the sonnets that contain the word light. Okay. You multiply all those light sonnets together, multiply the speed sonnets together. Speed of light is like a fraction, a quarter of something. So the speed goes on the bottom of the, is the denominator.
Sure.
Numerator top, light. Divide the number that you derive from speed sonnets and into the light sonnets, and it gives you a number. Is it the speed of light? No, not yet.
Right.
But then you go, well, wait a minute. Something to do with the pyramid, I know. What's the sonnet that contains the word pyramids? There's only one sonnet. It's sonnet 123. Obviously, 123, of course, a triangle. Sonnet 123. So you multiply by 123. Is it the speed of light yet? No, but then I realized, you know what? It's all he's talking about ancient Egypt. Probably he's giving us the speed of light in cubits per second, not meters. How do you convert cubits into meters? Very simple. You just multiply by pi over 6. So you get speed over light, gives you a number, multiply by 123, multiply by pi over 6, and it gives you the speed of light in meters per second. to 99.84% accuracy. We don't even match that for another 300 years yet.
I know. It's so mind-blowing. And there is another measurement related to the pyramid and the speed of light as well that I read recently. The measurement of the sides, I believe, or maybe the square root or the square area of the pyramid is equal to the speed of light.
It's quite simple. I had put this out in 2016. If you take an inscribed circle inside the square base of the pyramid and the exoscribed circle, that's a circle that touches all the corners outside, subtract the circumference of the inner one from the circumference of the outer one, and it is so close, it gives you basically the speed of light in
qubits.
Giving it in qubits. The other thing, the other reference is that the actual latitude of the Great Pyramid is 29.979245 degrees. Well, that's the speed of light in meters per second.
That's what it was. Yes.
29.92458. So all these things are showing us that whoever built the pyramids, they were telling us that we know the speed of light, and we've encoded it into the pyramid. So along comes Shakespeare, with John Dee, leading mathematician and scientist at the time, really. He's embedded it into the cover of the sonnets. I have a little 11-minute video on that if anybody's interested. Just go to it and see it. It's quite stunning because you see, just by connecting the dots on the cover of the sonnet, it gives you six perfect right-angle triangles with a circle going through all of them, and two of them are giving you the precise geographic coordinates of the Great Pyramid. It's also giving you a ton of mathematical constants. So in other words, they knew these seemingly unknown mathematical constants and things that they should have no way of knowing. So the only answer is what you said. It's the Freemasonic fraternities passing down this knowledge from higher ages when it was known, keeping it safe, hidden in cloisters, wherever, to get through the dark ages. Well, that's a cycle of what? It's like 24,000 years, isn't it?
It's a big cycle, yeah.
So keeping this all the way while we're going down into the Kali Yuga, where we're burning books and burning people and, you know, having a lot of fun being wonderful barbarians. And you come out the other side. Hey, we've still got it. And we're incorporating it here, as Da Vinci has done, as Shakespeare has done, as John Dee has done, as all these great masters who were all connected to these fraternities. Debussy, Mozart put Freemasonic codes into the magic flute. You know what I mean?
Right.
All of these great masters who are knowledgeable have put it into their art in a way to assure that it continues. How do we know that Shakespeare is a Rosicrucian? Well, the basic three publications that came out by the Rosicrucians in 16, 14, 15, and 16. One of them is called The Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz and the Knights of the Golden Stone. Christian Rosenkreutz, Golden Stone. You've got two characters in Hamlet, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Oh, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, Rosenkreutz and Goldenstone. I wonder if there's a connection. Probably not. It's coincidence, say the scholars. You know, I mean, it's just kind of willful blindness. It's like, no, let's not go there, because the man from Stratford certainly couldn't have been a Rosicrucian.
Well, I do want to add to what you're saying. John Dee and Ed DeVeers, or the people working with him, worked on this, you believe, for over 30 years, creating these codes and these sonnets and the works of Shakespeare and having it all encoded. It was a 30-year process, you believe.
Well, if you look to the very first things, Venus and Adonis, right? First time we ever see the name Shakespeare. And that's in 1593. And then Rape of Lucrece in 1594. Those are both dedicated to the Earl of Southampton, Henry Wriothesley. But it's the first time we see the name William Shakespeare. So that's 1593. All the way up to when the folio comes out. First folio comes out of all 36 plays. That's 1623. That's 30 years. And there are codes in the numbers of stanzas in Venus and Adonis that match precisely the same codes that are in And here's another big, mind bender in the King James Bible.
Right.
I have proven, honestly, it was definitely proven that Shakespeare had a hand in translating the King James Bible. So you can see that if you want to give links to that. I don't know if you want to do
that. Show is out there. I mean, we'll talk about that. I will definitely put all the links to everything on the website. But the show is out there explaining this in detail. But this is just really powerful. And you feel like now you're discovering this. It's time. Humanity's frequency has raised. It's time for this information to come out. A lot of information is coming out all over the place. A lot of mystery school knowledge and ancient Lemurian, Atlantean. But in your conduit, in this area, it's time for this specific information to come out.
I think it's all part and parcel of the same thing, actually. It's not sort of a separate incident. It is, if you want to look at it, that's Shakespeare. Is it anything to do with, like, disclosure, extraterrestrial life?
It's all connected.
To do with possibly political systems dissolving and collapsing in the economic system. I mean, it's all part and parcel of the Earth is going through a massive change. If we are to survive, we have to shift our consciousness and get a bit more awake. And it's probably not the right term to use right now. I'll use it. Whoa, wake up.
It's confusing. Wake up. Raise your vibration.
But that's what it is, isn't it? So all these things are happening simultaneously in various areas, but they are also, of course, interconnected.
Oh, my God. This has been an incredible interview, Alan. So much that we've talked about here. I do want to kind of tell people where to find you, because here's the thing. There's so much information. Alan really just scratched the surface. He gave you the story, a little bit of the bare bones, but you've got to take the deeper dive. There's a book, Decoding Shakespeare, D-E-E, Coding Shakespeare. And then the show on Gaia TV, Shakespeare Decoded, is there at his website, tobeornottobe.org. That's a place where you'll find everything. The little videos, the show, access to the show, the books that have been published, the books that are coming. It's all there on the website. And I want to ask you about the Shakespeare Foundation. Let's close with that. So is that the purpose of the Shakespeare Foundation now? To get the altar stone analyzed, to get this information out to the public sphere?
Exactly. It has a bigger overall purpose, and that is to support research and the arts in general and education. So I've just launched it just last week. We've launched theshakespearefoundation.org.
Oh, wow.
Please go along there. And if you feel moved to give us any kind of donation at all that is going towards the arts, because what's always underfunded is the arts, right? I mean, we all know that. And so it's been a long time dream of mine to have a foundation in the name of the true Shakespeare. Because actually, if it turns out that Shakespeare is Edward de Vere, was probably the most underappreciated patron of the arts in his own time. He bought a place in London called Fisher's Folly. All of the artists and poets and playwrights and philosophers of the time would come to be in his orbit. And he was the wealthiest man in the nation. And he just used all his money to support artists, not only his own works, but to support everyone else's. And he just put on all, he published their works, etc. So he was the original patron of the arts. So it's only right that we have a foundation in his name that is supporting the arts. But the first goal is, yes, to get the altar open, because that will open the floodgates.
Yes, and just like you were saying, it will generate revenue for the arts. You find those original manuscripts are priceless, potentially billions of dollars, but the amount of tourist revenue for the church, and then that would go to the arts. But let me just ask you this before we go. Do you feel like it's close? Do you feel like intuitively and with the people you interact with and the energy you experience, do you feel like it'll happen? Do you feel like we're going to get into that altar and verify this finally?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. A couple of miracles have happened even in my first week here. I would just like to mention that on top of the foundation, I just put out a song called Say a Prayer for Will. And so there'll be a link to that.
Nice.
I recorded it about a month ago, and it's produced by James Guthrie, my longtime friend. He and I worked together, first of all, 46 years ago on my Arista album. And here we were working on this. He's Pink Floyd's producer. He produced The Wall.
Oh, wow.
Everything on from there. So it's really beautifully produced. He did an incredible job. And it's online, and you can buy it for $1 or whatever you want to donate. All of it goes to the foundation to support the arts. Because here's a statistic. You know, in America, every $100 that the government invests in science, and I'm not saying we shouldn't invest in science, we should, but for every $100 that is invested in science, you know how much is invested in the arts?
A penny. 25 cents.
Yeah, close. 46 cents. $100, 46 cents. Obviously, we need to, you know, so when this story changes and the books get sold to every school, college, university in the world that teaches Shakespeare, it will become a billion-dollar foundation, and there'll be plenty of money to support the arts. It's inevitable because the whole paradigm will shift, and schools will have to teach the true story. There'll be a new true story, and very exciting. It'll be that moment in Wizard of Oz that goes from black and white to technical. It's like, oh, we've
got it. Yes.
So that song is there, and I would like—I really appreciate it if people would go look for that. Say a Prayer for Will. It really is. I'm blowing my own trumpet, but it is gorgeous, and not least of which because James Guthrie of Pink Floyd fame produced it. It's really something. He played bass and guitar on it as well. I played all the keyboards and sang it and wrote the song. It's good. It's a good thing. But is it going to happen now? Yeah, I believe it is. I believe we're at that cusp of where so many things are changing, right? Politically, religiously, historically, and we have to. We've got to. I think we all know that we've got to in order to save the remnants of this planet, because we have been abusing the planet for so long, and it's straining under the wear of our terrible treatment of it. So yeah, I think it's going to happen. I do. But isn't it happening faster? Don't you notice that?
I do notice that. The guests I talk to, there's a quickening of awakening, and it's exponentially, it's like a snowball rolling downhill. Everyone's waking up. I have guests from all over the world. I have listeners in 185 countries, and people are sending me messages. Everybody's getting this. Everybody's waking up. I've been studying New Age content for a very long time, close to 40 years, well, 35 years. And everyone is now coalescing on various points and opinions. Used to have wildly varying perspectives in New Age circles. Now everyone, the channelers, the intuitives, the psychics, everyone's kind of honing in on what you're talking about. It's time for a new earth. It's time for humanity to love each other again, become a united earth, and ascend to that place that is our birthright. It truly is our birthright, the united earth under love. We can do that.
Yes, absolutely. Well, one last thing that would blow
of course, your please.
You know what the name of that altar stone is? The Holy of Holies altar stone, where Shakespeare says he's left something for us that I have scanned, that you can see the picture of it. The Hebrew name for that altar stone, for the Holy of Holies, is Devere.
Oh, snap! I love this!
All these references to Edward de Vere maybe being the real Shakespeare, it works equally if really just talking about the altar stone itself. It comes from the Hebrew word devarim, which means word. So literally de Vere has this very special connotation of literally the first word. Right, well, in the beginning was the word, and the word was with God, and the word was God, right? Or let there be light. What happens when we have a creation? We go from unity consciousness, nothing's happening, still nothing happening. Let's have a creation. Oh, bonf, right? We're in duality immediately, right? And we're going, well, you know, as Shakespeare says, all the world's a stage. Let's have a drama, yeah. So that moment, though, of course, that's vibration.
Yes.
What is that? The original word, de Verim, which is de Vir. So it's de Vir means holy of holies. It's Om, really. It's the Om vibration.
Oh my God.
The original word, the original vibration. So isn't that cool?
It's mind-blowing.
The actual altar stone itself is called the
de Vir. De Vir. Oh, my God.
The writer put the stuff in there. His name is de Vir. So his name means holy of holies, but just the Latin portion of it, Vir, means truth or true. So here's what's happening, and I just love this metaphor because it really puts into perspective what really is happening. Because most people who approach the Shakespeare mystery, alternative, I'm saying now, non-Stratfordians, people who think it's Bacon or think it's Marlowe or think
right.
it's Oxford or whatever, they always come to it from the perspective of, oh, you know, the Stratford guy stole our man's identity. Even in the very good movie of Roland Emmerich's Anonymous, it's even there. It's like, oh, he stole it and he shouldn't have. It's not that at all. What it is Shakespeare is the mask, right? He's literally a mask. It's that engraving that we see that is a ludicrously joke of an engraving that's in the first folio. The picture of a head is twice as big as it should be. It's hovering up above the rest of the body. The jacket is half of a front and half of a back. He has two right eyes. There's a line down the face here showing that it's a mask. His hair is lopsided, it's long here and short there. There's all kinds of clues in that silly engraving. But what it is a mask. Behind the mask is the truth, right? So what they are doing here is literally saying, De Vir, the truth, is hiding behind a mask. He was deliberately anonymous. Let's make this the mask. Let's say this guy's, he's the writer, right? We are all Shakespeare, and we are all De Vir. It's just saying the same thing that all great religions say, the kingdom of God is within you. Take off that mask. And the reveal the truth inside. So it's not that one of them was a fake guy and the other was the real guy. No, it's a metaphor. It's a spiritual metaphor for the actual truth of creation that we are it. You're it. I'm it. Get used to it. You might still be Shakespeare bumbling around, not knowing Italy like the back of your hand. Or you might be just waking up and realizing, oh, yeah, I am. I'm this as well. To me, that's the most beautiful part of it. It is a scripture.
The metaphor, the example, showing us that we are divinity. We are the light. The illusion is the mask. The play is the play. We're in the play. Like you said, all the world's a stage. Incredible episode, Alan. I'm so glad you have come on. We need to have you back at some point. We just kind of barely scratched the surface, and I know there's so much more coming. We'll have you back again. Again, let me just remind people where to find you, tobeornottobe.org. And I forgot to mention the Bardcast podcast. We love podcasts here. Go check that out. And Alan, thank you again so much for being here. Is there anything else you'd like to leave our audience with before you go?
No, it's just add to that last thought of the mask covering up who we truthfully are. I believe that's the actual meaning of to be or not to be.
Yes.
I finish the Gaia series with that. I say, you know, what he's really saying with to be or not to be is we all have the choice to be who we truly are, the I am that I am, or not to be. We can carry on wearing this mask, our communal mask of our communal Midsummer Night's Dream, that we're all in a dream, right? And we can carry on and we can incarnate 10 times, 100 times, a million times. You've got an eternity, it doesn't matter. And Shakespeare's saying, I don't mind that either. I love drama. Yeah, you can do that if you want. To be or not to be. The whole question is you to be who you truly are or not to be. Just keep that mask on. But once you know who you truly are, once you have pierced the veil and realized that you've been wearing a mask and that the De Vir, the truth, is hiding inside you, right behind you, then I feel you have an obligation to speak that truth, like we're all doing it in various ways. And speak that truth to others who are not yet awake. You know, Yogananda says it so beautifully. He says, I am, there's no difference between us. I am the awakened God, waking the sleeping God in you. There's no difference.
Right.
You're still asleep. I'm awake. I got there. Right. I've come back to wake you up. So it's the same thing. To be
or not to be. Yes. And we are all one. We're all one to be or not to be, living in the matrix. That's your choice. So, wow, that was incredible, Alan. Thank you so much for being here. It's been amazing. You're amazing.
Thank you, Jake.
Okay. And everyone, what an episode. Alan, please hold through the outro music. Check out the website, tobeornottobe.org. So much going on there. Check out the show on Gaia like I did. It's incredible. It's engrossing. And we will see you next week, midnight on Earth.